I mean,
some of the scenes you will witness may appear to border on fantasy.
I can game it in a big way.
When ignorance is converted into knowledge.
Yes, you.
But
tonight
we care, and it shows.
The law.
Of course. You will listen and obey.
The country.
You will remember nothing you have seen or heard here.
Whether he went on with the diary or whether he did not cooperate, it made no difference. The thought police would get him just the same.
Oswald, which makes 2 days ago the 43rd anniversary of the death of John F. Kennedy. So for this first hour, I'm going to give you a montage of things Kennedy related. Everything from the Oliver Stone movie to Bill Hicks to the man himself. And then we'll come back and get into all the news and views.
Information is free. There is hope.
Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, I appreciate very much your generous invitation to be here tonight. You bear heavy responsibilities these days, and an article I read some time ago reminded me of how particularly heavily the burdens of present-day events bear upon your profession. You may remember that in 1851, New York Herald Tribune, under the sponsorship and publishing of Horace Greeley, employed as its London correspondent an obscure journalist by the name of Karl Marx. We are told that foreign correspondent Marx, stone broke, and with a family ill and undernourished, constantly appealed to Greeley and managing editor Charles Dana for an increase in his munificent salary of $5 per installment, a salary which he and Ingalls ungratefully labeled as the lousiest petty bourgeois cheating. But when all his financial appeals were refused, Marx looked around for other means of livelihood and fame, eventually terminating his relationship with the Tribune and devoting his talents full time to the cause that would bequeath to the world the seeds of Leninism, Stalinism, revolution, and the Cold War. If only this capitalistic New York newspaper had... had treated him more kindly. If only Marx had remained a foreign correspondent, history might have been different. And I... hope all publishers will bear this lesson in mind the next time they receive a poverty-stricken appeal from a small increase in the expense account from an obscure newspaper man. I have selected as the title of my remarks tonight, The President and the Press. Some may suggest that this would be more naturally worded, The President versus the Press, but those are not my sentiments tonight. It is true, however, that when a well-known diplomat from another country demanded recently that our State Department repudiate certain newspaper attacks on his colleagues, it was unnecessary for us to reply that this administration was not responsible for the press had already made it clear that it was not responsible for this administration. Nevertheless, my purpose here tonight is not to deliver the usual assault on the so-called one-party press. On the contrary, in recent months, I have rarely heard any complaints about political bias in the press, except from a few Republicans. Nor is it my purpose tonight to discuss or defend the televising of presidential press conferences. I think it is highly beneficial to have some 20 million Americans regularly sit in on these conferences to observe, if I may say so, the incisive, the intelligent, and the courteous qualities displayed by your Washington correspondents. Nor, finally, are these remarks intended to examine the proper degree of privacy which the press should allow to any president and his family. If in the last few months your White House reporters and photographers have been attending church services with regularity, that has surely done them no harm. On the other hand, I realize that your staff and wire service photographers may be complaining that they do not enjoy the same green privileges, the local golf courses, which they once did. It is true that my predecessor did not object, as I do, to pictures of one's golfing skill in action. But neither, on the other hand, did he ever been a Secret Service man. My topic tonight is a more sober one, of concern to publishers as well as editors. I want to talk about our common responsibilities in the face of a common danger. The events of recent weeks may have helped to illuminate that challenge for some, but the dimensions of its threat have loomed large on the horizon for many years. Whatever our hopes may be for the future, for reducing this threat or living with it, there is no escaping either the gravity or the totality of its challenge to our survival and to our security, a challenge that confronts us in unaccustomed ways in every sphere of human activity. This deadly challenge imposes upon our society two requirements of direct concern, both to the press and to the president. Two requirements that may seem almost contradictory in tone, but which must be reconciled and fulfilled if we are to meet this national peril. I refer first to the need for far greater public information, and second, to the need for far greater official secrecy. The very word secrecy is repugnant in a free and open society, and we are, as a people, inherently and historically opposed to secret societies, to secret oaths, and to secret proceedings. We decided long ago that the dangers of excessive and unwarranted concealment of pertinent facts far outweighed the dangers which are cited to justify it. Even today, there is little value in opposing the threat of a closed society by imitating its arbitrary restrictions. Even today, there is little value in ensuring the survival of our nation if our traditions do not survive with it. And there is very grave danger that an announced need for increased security will be seized upon by those anxious to expand its meaning to the very limits of official censorship and concealment. That I do not intend to permit to the extent that it's in my control. And no official of my administration, whether his rank is high or low, civilian or military, should interpret my words here tonight as an excuse to censor the news, to stifle dissent, to cover up our mistakes, or to withhold from the press and the public the facts they deserve to know. But I do ask, every publisher, every editor, and every newsman in the nation to re-examine his own standards and to recognize the nature of our country's peril. In time of war, the government and the press have customarily joined in an effort based largely on self-discipline to prevent unauthorized disclosures to the enemy. In times of clear and present danger, the courts have held that even the privileged rights of the First Amendment must yield to the public's need for national security. Today, no war has been declared, and however fierce the struggle may be, it may never be declared in the traditional fashion. Our way of life is under attack. Those who make themselves our enemy are advancing around the globe. The survival of our friends is in danger. And yet no war has been declared. No borders have been crossed by marching troops. No missiles have been fired. If the press is awaiting a declaration of war, before it imposes the self-discipline of combat conditions, then I can only say that no war ever posed a greater threat to our security. If you are awaiting a finding of clear and present danger, then I can only say that the danger has never been more clear and its presence has never been more imminent. It requires a change in outlook, a change in tactics, a change in missions by the government, by the people, by every businessman or labor leader, and by every newspaper. For we are opposed around the world by a monolithic and ruthless conspiracy that relies primarily on covert means for expanding its sphere of influence, on infiltration instead of invasion, on subversion instead of elections, on intimidation instead of free choice, on guerrillas by night instead of armies by day. It is a system which has conscripted vast human and material resources into the building of a tightly knit, highly efficient machine that combines military, diplomatic, intelligence, economic, scientific, and political operations. Its preparations are concealed, not published. Its mistakes are buried, not headlined. Its dissenters are silenced, not praised. No expenditure is questioned, no rumor is printed, no secret is revealed. It conducts the Cold War in short, with a wartime discipline no democracy would ever hope or wish to match. Nevertheless, every democracy recognizes the necessary restraints of national security. And the question remains whether those restraints need to be more strictly observed if we are to oppose this kind of attack as well as outright invasion. But the facts of the matter are that this nation's foes have openly boasted of acquiring through our newspapers information they would otherwise hire agents to acquire through theft, bribery, or espionage, that details of this nation's covert preparations to counter the enemy's covert operations have been available to every newspaper reader, friend and foe alike, that the size, the strength, the location, and the nature of our forces and weapons, and our plans and strategy for their use, have all been pinpointed in the press and other news media to a degree sufficient to satisfy any foreign power, and that in at least one case, the publication of details concerning a secret mechanism whereby satellites were followed required its alteration at the expense of considerable time and money. The newspapers which printed these stories were loyal, patriotic, responsible, and well-meaning. Had we been engaged in open warfare, they undoubtedly would not have published such items. But in the absence of open warfare, they recognized only the tests of journalism and not the tests of national security. And my question tonight is whether additional tests should not now be adopted. That question is for you alone to answer. No public official should answer it for you. No governmental plan should impose its restraints against your will. But I would be failing in my duty to the nation in considering all of the responsibilities that we now bear and all of the means at hand to meet those responsibilities if I did not command this problem to your attention and urge its thoughtful consideration. On many earlier occasions I have said, and your newspapers have constantly said, that these are times that appeal to every citizen's sense of sacrifice and self-discipline. They call out to every citizen to weigh his rights and comforts against his obligations to the common good. I cannot now believe that those citizens who serve in the newspaper business consider themselves exempt from that appeal. I have no intention of establishing a new office of war information to govern the flow of news. I am not suggesting any new forms of censorship or new types of security classifications. I have no easy answer to the dilemma that I have posed and would not seek to impose it if I had one. But I am asking the members of the newspaper profession and the industry in this country to re-examine their own responsibilities, to consider the degree and the nature of the present danger, and to heed the duty of self-restraint which that danger imposes upon us all. Every newspaper now asks itself, with respect to every story, is it news? All I suggest is that you add the question, is it in the interest of national security? And I hope that every group in America, unions and businessmen and public officials at every level, will ask the same question of their endeavors and subject their actions to this same exacting test. And should the press of America consider and recommend the voluntary assumption of specific new steps or machinery, I can assure you that we will cooperate wholeheartedly with those recommendations. Perhaps there will be no recommendations. Perhaps there is no answer to the dilemma faced by a free and open society in a cold and secret war. In times of peace, any discussion of this subject and any action that results are both painful and without precedent. But this is a time of peace and peril which knows no precedent in history. It is the unprecedented nature of this challenge that also gives rise to your second obligation, an obligation which I share. And that is our obligation to inform and alert the American people, to make certain that they possess all the facts that they need and understand them as well, the perils, the prospects, the purposes of our program, and the choices that we face. No president should fear public scrutiny of his program, for from that scrutiny comes understanding, and from that understanding comes support or opposition, and both are necessary. I am not asking your newspapers to support an administration, but I am asking your help in the tremendous task of informing and alerting the American people. For I have complete confidence. And the response and dedication of our citizens whenever they are fully informed. I not only could not stifle controversy among your readers, I welcome it. This administration intends to be candid about its errors. For as a wise man once said, an error doesn't become a mistake until you refuse to correct it. We intend to accept full responsibility for our errors, and we expect you to point them out when we miss them. Without debate, without criticism, no administration and no country can succeed, and no republic can survive. That is why the Athenian lawmaker Solon decreed it a crime for any citizen to shrink from controversy. And that is why our press was protected by the First Amendment, the only business in America specifically protected by the Constitution, not primarily to amuse and entertain, not to emphasize the trivial and the sentimental, not to simply give the public what it wants, but to inform, to arouse, to reflect, to state our dangers and our opportunities, to indicate our crises and our choices, to lead, mold, educate, and sometimes even anger public opinion. This means greater coverage and analysis of international news, for it is no longer far away and foreign, but close at hand and local. It means greater attention to improved understanding of the news, as well as improved transmission. And it means, finally, that government at all levels must meet its obligation to provide you with the fullest possible information outside the narrowest limits of national security, and we intend to do it. It was early in the 17th century that Francis Bacon remarked on three recent inventions already transforming the world: the compass, gunpowder, and the printing press. Now the links between the nations, first forged by the compass, have made us all citizens of the world, the hopes and threats of one becoming the hopes and threats of us all. In that one world's effort to live together, the evolution of gunpowder to its ultimate limit has warned mankind of the terrible consequences of failure. And so it is to the printing press, to the recorder of man's deeds, the keeper of his conscience, the courier of his news, that we look for strength and assistance, confident that with your help, man will be what he was born to be, free and independent.
Boy, I love talking about Kennedy's assassination, man. That's my favorite topic. You know why?
Why?
Because to me, it's a great archetype example of how the totalitarian government who rules this planet partitions out information in such a way that we, the masses, are forced to base our conclusions on erroneous... Oh, I'm sorry, wrong meeting. I thought this was the meeting at the docks, no? Oh, shit, that's tomorrow night. All right. Everyone followed that. That's the frightening fucking thing. Everyone here is going, uh-huh. God damn it, are we that cynical? Yes, we are, Bill. We will take any blow you give us. Go! We too will be at the meeting at the docks tomorrow, you fucker. Funny. Everyone is woo with you. Wow. Cool. But I love Kennedy, man. I was just down in, I was just in Dallas, and, you know, you can go to the sixth floor of the School Book Depository. Do you know it's a museum called the Assassination Museum? Do you know that? True. I believe named that after the assassination. I can't be sure of the chronology here, but... But it's really weird. You can actually, they have the windows set up to look exactly like it did on that day. And it's really accurate, you know, because Oswald's not in it. Yeah, so. I don't know who did their research, but I'm talking painstaking detail. It's true, man. It's called the sniper's nest, and it's all glassed in with the boxes sitting there. You can't actually get to the window. And the reason they did that, of course, they didn't want thousands of American tourists getting to that window each year, you know, going, there's no fucking way! I can't even see the road! Oh, my God, they're lying. It's a giant totalitarian government that rules the planet via the airwaves, partitioning off information in such a way... There's no fucking way, man. Not unless Oswald was hanging by his toes upside down from the ledge. Surely someone would have seen this. Either that or some pigeons grabbed onto him and flew him over the motorcade. You know, there was rumors of anti-Castro pigeons seen drinking in bars the night before the assassination. Someone overheard them saying, coup, coup. All right. Don't get on your we hate puns high horse. Fuck you. That is the best goddamn pun you will ever hear. Well, it's kind of a rotten trick to make a pun out of that, wasn't it? You... Oh. Jack. But, you know, Oswald. I'd say it's interesting. nasty, man, talking about Kennedy assassination. Because to me, it really is. It's an incredible example of something. I don't know what yet. It's pretty engrossing to me. But people's attitudes, it's just incredible to me, you know? People come up to me, Bill, quit talking about Kennedy, man. Let it go. It's a long time ago. Would you just forget about it? I'm like, okay, then don't bring up Jesus to me. As long as we're talking shelf life here. Bill, you know, Jesus died for you. Yeah, it was a long time ago. Let it go. Forget about it. How about this? Get Pilate to release the fucking files. Quit washing your hands and release the files, Pilate. Who else was on that grassy Golgotha that day? Oh, yeah, the three Roman peasants with the $100 sandals. Yeah, right.
A lot of people that day were deciding what was private, none of the American people's business. The chief pathologist, Commander Humes, by his own admission, voluntarily burned his autopsy notes. President Johnson orders the blood-soaked limousine filled with bullet holes and clues to be immediately washed and rebuilt. He sends John Connally's bloody suit right to the cleaners. The Justice Department denied this office access to the autopsy photos. And when we finally get a court order to examine President Kennedy's brain in the National Archives in the hopes of finding from which direction the bullet came from, we're told by the government, your government, that the president's brain has disappeared. That's not all that's disappeared, gentlemen. With it, I think, the concept of justice.
Objection, Your Honor. Not only is Mr. Garrison insulting the federal government, but he is also introducing a highly subjective...
So what really happened that day? Let's just for a moment speculate, shall we? We have the epileptic seizure around 12:15 p.m., distracting the police, making it easier for the shooters to move into their places. The epileptic later vanished, never checking into the hospital. The A-team gets on the sixth floor of the depository. Now, they were refurbishing the floors in the depository that week, which allowed unknown workmen in and out of the building. They moved quickly into position, just minutes before the shooting. The second spotter on the radio talking to the other two teams has the best overall view. The God Spotter. B team, one rifleman and one spotter with the headset and access to the building, moves into the low floor of the Daltex building. The third team, the C team, moves in behind the picket fence above the grassy knoll where the shooter and the spotter are first seen by the late Lee Bowers in the watchtower of the rail yard. They have the best position of all. Kennedy is close and on a flat, low trajectory. Part of this team is a coordinator who's flashed security credentials at several people chasing them out of the parking lot area. Probably two to three more men are down in the crowd on L. 10 to 12 men, three teams, three shooters. The triangulation of fire Clay Shaw and David Ferry discussed 2 months before. They've walked the plaza. They know every inch. They've calibrated their sights. They've practiced on moving targets. They're ready. Kennedy's motor team makes a turn from Maine on to Houston. It's gonna be a turkey shoot. They don't shoot him coming up Houston, which is the easiest shot for a single shooter in the book depository. They wait. They wait till he gets to the killing zone between three rifles. Kennedy makes the final turn from Houston on the L. Slowing down to some 11 miles an hour. The shooters across Dealey Plaza tighten, taking their aim. Waiting for the radio to say, green, green, or abort, abort. The first shot rings out, sounding like a backfire. It misses the car completely. Frame 161, Kennedy stops waving as he hears something. Connally's head turns slightly to the right.
Frame 193, the second shot hits Kennedy in the throat from the front. Frame 225, the president emerging from behind the road sign. You can see that he's obviously been hit, raising his arms to his throat. The third shot, frame 232, hits Kennedy in the back, pulling him downward and forward. Conley, you will notice, shows no signs at all of being hit. He is visibly holding his Stetson, which is impossible if his wrist has been shattered. Conley is turning here now. Frame 238, the fourth shot. It misses Kennedy and takes Conley in the back. This is the shot that proves there were two rifles. Conley yells out, "My God, they're going to kill us all." Somewhere around this time now, another shot that misses the car completely strikes James Craig down by the underpass. Car breaks. The sixth and fatal shot, frame 313, takes Kennedy in the head from the front. This is the key shot. The president going back and to his left. Shot from the front and right. Totally inconsistent with the shot from the depository. Again. Back and to the left. Back and to the left. Back and to the left. So what happens then? Pandemonium.
Get the hell out of here. We got it, buddy.
Was quickly disassembled their various weapons, all except the Oswald rifle. Patrolman Joe Smith rushes into the parking lot behind the picket fence. He smells gunpowder.
The character produced credentials from his pocket that showed him to be Secret Service.
So see your ID. You see anybody else up here?
No, keep looking.
So I accepted that and let him go and continued the search. But I regretted it because this guy looked like an auto mechanic. He had on a sport shirt and pants, but he had dirty fingernails. Afterward, it didn't ring true, but at the time, we were so pressed for time.
Yet all Secret Servicemen in Dallas that day are accounted for. None were on foot in duty trials before or after the shooting until Dallas Secret Service Chief Forrest Oils returned to 1255. At least 12 other individuals were taken into custody by Dallas police. No record of their arrest. Men acting like hobos were being pulled off trains, marched through Dealey Plaza, photographed, and yet there's no records of their arrest. Men identifying themselves as Secret Service agents all over the place. But who was impersonating them? And where was Lee Harvey Oswald? Around 12:15, on her way out of the building to see the motorcade, Secretary Carolyn Arnold sees Oswald in the second floor snack room, where he said he went for a coat.
He was in a booth on the right side of the room. He's by himself, as usual, here to be having his lunch. I didn't speak to him, but I recognized him clearly.
At the same time, Bonnie Ray Williams is supposedly eating his chicken lunch in the sixth floor. He's there until 12:15, maybe 12:20. He sees nobody. Arnold Rowland's down on the street. He's looking up. He sees two men in the sixth floor window, presumably after Bonnie Ray Williams had finished his lunch and left. John Powell, prisoner on the sixth floor of the Dallas County Jail, sees them.
Quite a few of us guys saw them. Everybody was hollering and yelling and all that. We thought they were security guys.
If Oswald was the assassin, he was certainly pretty nonchalant about moving himself into position. Later, he told Dallas police he was in the second floor snack room. Probably told to wait there by his handler for a phone call. But the phone call never came. A maximum 90 seconds after Kennedy is shot, patrolman Marion Baker runs into Oswald in that second floor lunchroom.
Hey, you! You know this man is an employee.
Yes, he is. The president's been shot.
But what the Warren Commission would have us believe is that after firing three bolt-action shots in 5.6 seconds, Oswald then leaves three cartridges neatly side-by-side in the firing nest, wipes the rifle clear of fingerprints, stashes the rifle on the other side of the lock, sprints down five flights of stairs past witnesses Victoria Adams and Sandra Stiles, who never see him. He shows up cool and calm on the second floor in front of Patrolman Baker. All this within a maximum of 90 seconds of the shooting.
Hey, you! You know this man? Is he an employee?
Yes, he is. The president's been shot.
Is he out of breath? According to Baker, absolutely not. Assuming he is the sole assassin, Oswald is now free to escape from the building. The longer he delays, the more chance the building will be sealed by police. Is he guilty? Does he walk out the nearest staircase? No. He buys a Coke. And at a slow pace, spotted by Mrs. Reed on the second floor, he strolls out the more distant front exit, where the cops have gathered. Oddly, considering the three shots have been fired from there, nobody seals the book depository for 10 more minutes. Oswald slips out, as do several other employees. Of course, when he realized something had gone wrong and the president had been killed, he knew there was a problem. He may have even known he was the patsy, an intuition maybe. The president killed in spite of his warning, the phone call that never came. Perhaps fear now came to Oswald for the very first time. So Oswald returns to his rooming house around 1 p.m., a half hour after the assassination.
A man shot the president.
He puts on his jacket, grabs his .38 revolver, and leaves at 1:04. Earlene Roberts, the housekeeper, says she heard two beeps on a car horn, and two uniformed cops pulled up to the house where Oswald was in his room like it was a signal or something. Officer Tippett is shot between 1:10 and 1:15, about a mile away. And though no one actually saw him walking or jogging, the government says Oswald covered that distance. Now, giving the government the benefit of the doubt, Oswald would have had to jog a mile in 6 to 11 minutes and then commit the murder,
right here, sir?
Then reverse his direction and walk 3/5 of the mile to the Texas Theater and arrive sometime before 1:30. It's also a useful conclusion, after all. Why else would Oswald kill Tippett unless he'd just shot the president and feared arrest? Domingo Benavides, closest witness to the shooting, refused to identify Oswald as the killer and was never taken to a lineup. Akilah Clemens saw the killer with another man and says they went off in separate directions. Mrs. Clemens was never taken to a lineup or to the Warren Commission. At the scene of the crime, Officer J.M. Poe marks the shelves with his initials to record the chain of evidence.
Winchester.
Those initials are not on the three cartridge cases which the Warren Commission present to him. As early as 12:44, only 14 minutes after the assassination, the police radio put out a description matching Oswald's size and build. Oswald is next seen by shoe salesman Johnny Brewer lurking along Jefferson Avenue. Oswald is scared. He begins to realize the full implications of this thing. He goes into the Texas Theater, possibly his prearranged meeting point. But though he has $14 in his pocket, he does not buy the 75-cent ticket. And Brewer has the cashier call the police. In response to the cashier's call, at least 30 officers and a fleet of patrol cars descend on the movie theater. Now, this has to be the most remarkable example of police intuition since the Reichstag fire. And I don't buy it. They knew. Someone knew Oswald was going to be there. Brewer helpfully leads the cops into the theater and from the stage points Oswald out.
There he is.
Sir, could I get you to stand up there?
This is it.
I am not resisting arrest! The police have their man. It's already been decided. In Washington. By the time he's brought out from the theater, a large crowd is waiting to scream at him. Lee Oswald must have felt like Joseph K. to top guys at the trial. He's never told the reasons for his arrest. He doesn't know the unseen forces ranging against him. By the time he reached police headquarters, he is booked for murdering Tippett. No legal counsel is provided, no record made of the long questioning. By the time the sun rises the next morning, he is booked for murdering the president. The whole country, fueled by the media, assumes he is guilty. Under the guise of a patriotic nightclub owner out to spare Jackie Kennedy from having to testify at a trial, Jack Ruby is shown into an underground garage by one of his inside men on the Dallas police force. And when he is ready, Lee Harvey Oswald is brought out like a sacrificial lamb and nicely disposed of as an enemy of the people.
Oswald!
Who grieves for Lee Harvey Oswald? Buried in a cheap grave under the name Oswald? Nobody. Within minutes, false statements and press leaks about Lee Oswald circulate the globe. The official legend is created and the media takes it from there. The glitter of official lies and the epic splendor of the thought-numbing funeral of JFK confuse the eye and confound the understanding. Hitler always said, the bigger the lie, the more people will believe it. Lee Harvey Oswald, a crazed, lonely man who wanted attention and got it by killing a president, was only the first in a long line of patsies. In later years, Bobby Kennedy, Martin Luther King, men whose commitment to change and peace would make them dangerous to men who are committed to war, would follow. Also killed by such lonely, crazed men. Men who remove our guilt by making murder a meaningless act of a loner. We've all become Hamlets in our country, children of a slain father leader whose killer still possessed the throne. The ghost of John F. Kennedy confronts us with the secret murder at the heart of the American dream. He forces on us the appalling questions of what is our Constitution made? What is our citizenship and more, our lives worth? What is the future of a democracy where a president can be assassinated under conspicuously suspicious circumstances while the machinery of legal action scarcely trembles? How many more political murders disguised as heart attacks, suicides, cancers, drug overdoses? How many airplane and car crashes will occur before they are exposed for what they are? Treason doth never prosper, wrote an English poet. What's the reason? For if it prosper, none dare call it treason. The American public has yet to see the Zapruder film. Why? The American public has yet to see the real x-rays and photographs of the autopsy. Why? There are hundreds of documents that could help prove this conspiracy. Why are they being withheld or burned by the government? Each time my office or you, the people, have asked those questions, demanded crucial evidence, the answer from on high has always been national security. What kind of national security do we have when we've been robbed of our leaders? What national security permits the removal of fundamental power from the hands of the American people and validates the ascendancy of invisible government in the United States? That kind of national security, gentlemen, the jury, is when it smells like it, feels like it, and looks like it. You call it what it is. Fascism. I submit to you that what took place on November 22nd, 1963, was a coup d'etat. Its most direct and tragic result was the reversal of President Kennedy's commitment to withdraw from Vietnam. The war is the biggest business in America, worth $80 billion a year. President Kennedy was murdered by a conspiracy that was planned in advance at the highest levels of our government, and it was carried out by fanatical and disciplined cold warriors in the Pentagon and CIA's covert operation apparatus, among them Clay Shaw here before you. It was a public execution, and it was covered up by like-minded individuals in the Dallas Police Department, the Secret Service, the FBI, and the White House, all the way up to including J. Edgar Hoover and Lyndon Johnson, whom I consider accomplices after the fact. The assassination reduced the president to a transient official. His job, his assignment, is to speak as often as possible of this nation's desire for peace while he acts as a business agent in the Congress for the military and their hardware manufacturers. Now, some people say I'm crazy. Southern caricature seeking higher office. Well, there is a simple way to determine if I am paranoid. Let's ask the two men who profited the most from the assassination, your former president, Lyndon Baines Johnson, and your new president, Richard Nixon, to release the 51 CIA documents pertaining to Lee Harvey Oswald and Jack Ruby. or the secret CIA memo on Oswald's activities in Russia that was destroyed while being photocopied. All these documents are yours. The people's property. You pay for it. But because the government considers you children who might be too disturbed or distressed to face this reality, or because you might possibly lynch those involved, you cannot see these documents for another 75 years. I'm in my early 40s, so I'll have shuffled off this mortal coil by then, but I'm already telling my 8-year-old son to keep himself physically fit so that one glorious September morning in the year 2038, he can walk into the National Archives and find out what the CIA and the FBI knew. They may even push it back then. Hell, it may become a generational affair with questions passed down, father to son, mother to daughter. But someday, somewhere, someone may find out the damn truth. We better. We better, or we might just as well build ourselves another government, like the Declaration of Independence says to when the old one ain't working, just a little farther out west. The American naturalist wrote, "A patriot must always be ready to defend his country against its government." I'd hate to be in your shoes today. You have a lot to think about. You've seen much hidden evidence the American public has never seen. You know, going back to when we were children, I think that most of us in this courtroom thought that justice came into being automatically, that virtue was its own reward, that good would triumph over evil. But as we get older, we know this just isn't true. Individual human beings have to create justice, and this is not easy, because the truth often poses a threat to power, and one often has to fight power at great risk to themselves. People like S.M. Holland, Lee Bowers, Gene Hill, Willie O'Keefe have all taken that risk. They've all come forward. I have here some $8,000 in these letters sent to my office from all over the country. Quarters, dimes, dollar bills from housewives, plumbers, car salesmen, teachers, invalids. These are people who cannot afford to send money, but do. These are the ones who drive the cabs, who nurse in the hospitals, who see their kids go to Vietnam. Why? Because they care. Because they want to know the truth. Because they want the country back. Because it still belongs to us. As long as the people have the guts to fight for what they believe in. The truth is the most important value we have, because if the truth does not endure, if the government murders truth, if we cannot respect the hearts of these people, then this is not the country in which I was born in, and it's certainly not the country that I want to die in. Tennyson wrote, "Authority forgets a dying king." This was never more true than for John F. Kennedy, whose murder was probably one of the most terrible moments in the history of our country. You, the people, the jury system sitting in judgment on Clay Shaw, represent the hope of humanity against government power. In discharging your duty and bringing the first conviction in this house of cards against Clay Shaw, that's not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country. Do not forget your dying king. Show this world that this is still a government of the people, for the people, and by the people. Nothing as long as you live will ever be more important. It's up to you.
This feeling, man, because you know there's a handful of people actually run everything. That's true. It's provable. It's not a fuck. I'm not a conspiracy nut. It's provable. Handful, very small elite run and own these corporations, which include the mainstream media. I had this feeling who's ever elected president, like Clinton was, no matter what the promises you promise on the campaign trail, blah, 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 when you win, you go into this smoky room with the 12 industrialist capitalist scum fucks who got you in there, and you're in this smoky room, and this little film screen comes down, and a big guy in a cigar, roll the film. And it's a shot of a Kennedy assassination from an angle you've never seen before.
It looks suspiciously off the grassy knoll.
And then the film, the screen goes up, and the lights come up, and they go to the new president. Any questions? Just what my agenda is. First we bomb Baghdad. You got it.
You're listening to Media Monarchy on the Portland Radio Authority. That's praradio.com and mediamonarchy.blogspot.com. It's our fourth episode here on the Portland Radio Authority. It's November 24th, 2006, and we're celebrating, commemorating the 43rd anniversary of the death of John F. Kennedy. So we just heard from the late, great Bill Hicks. We also heard the full, uncut, director's cut version of the final speech, Kevin Costner in Oliver Stone's JFK. A little more Bill Hicks before that, and kicked it off with John F. Kennedy's speech from April 27th, 1961, called The President and the Press. And you can go get that off of mediamonarchy.blogspot.com. Some other related things I've got on there for the anniversary. You can watch the video of the Secret Service stand down, which is pretty impressive. And you can also listen to a podcast about the anniversary on Minnesota Public Radio. So my name's James. Welcome to the show. I hope you enjoyed that and found that interesting and enlightening, and hope you've realized the gravity and the importance that all this still holds today as we're under the 43rd president and thinking about the 43rd anniversary of the death of a president. So moving on to the news here on Media Monarchy, I always want to give a shout-out to what I think is the best talk show host in Portland, is Alex Ansari. His latest episode of Outside the Box, episode 78, is posted up on Media Monarchy. It's an interview with Jim Fetzer of Scholars for 9/11 Truth, and I'm sure they also get into JFK, as Jim Fetzer is a decades-long researcher. Also, something coming up today and this weekend on C-SPAN 3 on Book TV. They're showing the September 24th KPFA event from Berkeley, California, featuring David Ray Griffin, Kevin Ryan, Peter Dale Scott, Peter Phillips, and Ray McGovern. And it's called 9/11 and the American Empire, Intellectuals Speak Out. And that's on C-SPAN 3 today at 1 o'clock Pacific Time. And it's also on tomorrow at 12:30 a.m. Pacific Standard Time. So that's on C-SPAN 3, Book TV, 9/11, The American Empire. Jump into a story we've touched on, I think maybe on every episode of Media Monarchy so far. This is a new kink in the story. China admits selling prisoners' organs. This is coming from ABC News. For the first time, the Chinese government has admitted selling the organs of executed prisoners for a profit, a gruesome business it had denied for years. Speaking at a national conference of transplant surgeons in Gangzhou last week, Vice Minister of Health Huang Zhefu admitted, quote, apart from a small portion of traffic victims, most of the organs from cadavers are from executed prisoners, according to the China Daily, a state-run English-language newspaper published in Beijing. Harry Wu, a former political prisoner in China and human rights activist, says that Huang's statement is an important admission. 10 years ago, I talked about this. ABC and BBC reported. Congress held hearings about this, and China always denied it, saying, no, 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 never, said Wu. And this time, they said yes. Wu assisted ABC News' 1997 primetime investigation where the story, Blood Money, Black Market for Kidneys from Chinese Prisoners, first broke. According to the published account, the health vice minister complained that foreigners were getting a vast majority of their organs because they could better afford to pay than Chinese citizens. The cost of a prisoner's kidney has been estimated by human rights groups at about $90,000. Wu says that poor Chinese are selling their organs on the black market, even though it is now illegal in China to sell organs for profit. A Ministry of Health official in Beijing declined to comment, saying that ABC News needed to submit a written application for an interview. Sophie Richardson, an Asia expert for Human Rights Watch, says China still has a long way to go to improve its human rights standards. This is the beginning of an effort to look like it's responding to concerns about some pretty grotesque behavior. The Chinese government established a special committee to crack down on the Oregon black market earlier this year. Now we're going to listen to the audio of that 1997 primetime investigation. It's called Blood Money, the Selling of Organs.
On a sunny day in New York City, in a hotel room overlooking Central Park, we saw and heard something that for years the United States government has officially maintained does not happen. But our undercover videotape tells a different story, documenting for the first time in this country a grisly but lucrative international black market, the buying and selling of human organs, in this case a kidney, from the bodies of prisoners executed far away in China.
You will surely be satisfied with the arrangements for you, and the operation will surely be successful. I can guarantee this, no problem.
This was the starting point of a three-month primetime live investigation that took us from Central Park South in New York City to the back alleys of Hong Kong to a restricted military hospital in southern China, equipped with the latest in American medical technology.
It's a money-making operation. They're in business. This is an industry, and they're moving it around the world.
Dr. Ronald Gutman, an advisor to the International Transplantation Society, says it's been an open secret among doctors who do transplants that the Chinese military has been selling the kidneys of executed prisoners, perhaps thousands of them since the late 1980s.
In my opinion, a very barbaric and disgusting kind of practice. It makes me cringe, and I think exposing it is very important.
It's a question of supply and demand. A ready supply of prisoners to be executed, like these men, and a huge unmet demand for kidneys around the world. This Chinese military videotape, made in 1992 and never intended to be seen outside official circles, shows the condemned men and women paraded through the streets on their way to an execution field. This is a country which last year executed more than 4,000 people, some just petty thieves. It's not known what crimes these prisoners were convicted of, or whether the organs of any of them were about to be sold. But the tape shows guards precisely lining up their guns at the base of the skull. That makes retrieval of kidneys and organs much easier. And Dr. Gutman says certain medical preparations begin well before the execution.
They're given anticoagulant drugs so the blood won't clot when they're executed. They're given muscle relaxants.
And then, with a large crowd watching, the command is given.
After the execution, doctors removed the prisoner and placed him in the ambulance.
A Chinese doctor, Zhou Wei Chang, who now lives in Atlanta, told us what happens once the prisoners are dead, based on what he saw at his hospital just before he fled China in 1994.
First, there was a cut from the back to extract the kidneys. Dr. Chen from the surgical department also took out the eyeballs and a piece of skin from the dead prisoner's abdomen. The orthopedist cut out one section of the bone from the lower leg. All the extracted organs were placed in a special kind of liquid to maintain the freshness. Then they rushed back to the hospital. In the hospital, two patients were lying on the operating table waiting for the transplants. When the ambulance arrived, the kidneys were placed into the patients' bodies. All the other organs were only for laboratory experiments.
The rifle right away placed in the back.
The graphic tape was secretly removed from military archives and smuggled out of China by an underground group of dissidents and provided to Primetime Live by a former political prisoner who spent 19 years in a Chinese prison and has become China's most outspoken and despised critic, Harry Wu.
This is a fundamental violation of human rights.
Just straight ahead.
For the last 3 years, Wu has been traveling the world, trying to expose the black market in prisoners' body parts. which Wu says has spread from Asia to Europe and now to the United States, as he showed us with a recent copy of a Chinese language newspaper published in New York.
There's a small piece of advertisement right here.
What does that say?
Kidney transplant in mainland China. Don't miss the opportunity. Call.
So we did. Our call to the advertised number in Bridgeport, Connecticut, led to this meeting in a New York City hotel with a Chinese doctor and his wife, a Dr. and Mrs. Dai, who, with our hidden cameras rolling, told us they had already helped provide kidneys for several Americans, but that because of Harry Wu, everything had to be kept very quiet.
You've probably heard of Harry Wu. I have to be careful because people calling us might have the same agenda as Harry Wu. We are fully aware of the sensitive nature of this issue. Usually we don't talk about this.
With the help of a woman who works with Harry Wu, we told the Chinese doctor that a kidney was needed for a sick brother. The doctor told us, no problem, that he knew a month in advance that a new batch of prisoners' kidneys would soon be available.
At the end of July, there will definitely be kidney sources that will match your brother's situation in age and everything. If you are willing to go there around the 20th of July to receive a kidney from the July batch.
The total price for a transplanted kidney, according to Dr. Dai, $30,000 in cash, with a down payment to be made in New York.
If you decide to go ahead with this, then you pay us $5,000, and we will order and reserve a kidney and a bed in the hospital.
The hospital we were to be sent to is a hospital which, as the sign outside in English says, belongs to the PLA, the People's Liberation Army, called the Nanfeng Hospital, 3 hours north of Hong Kong. We came here as tourists, given the Chinese government's denial that it's in the business of selling the organs of executed prisoners. And we asked two Chinese dissidents to carry a hidden camera inside. This is the heart of the military's kidney business, an elaborate medical complex. Where patients told us numerous foreigners had just received or were waiting to receive kidney transplants, among hundreds of foreigners who have received kidneys here in the last few years.
I just talked to the doctor.
One of them was 38-year-old Apple Yunuch of Bangkok.
First time I asked the doctor, where can I get a kidney? And they said from a prisoner.
That prisoner's kidney is now in her body. And even though it saved her life, the experience has left Ms. Yunuch full of regret and willing to talk with Prime Time, breaking the circle of silence that has surrounded what goes on at the Nanfeng Military Hospital. First, she said, doctors in China took her blood and tissue samples and then sent her home to wait.
3rd of January, the doctor called me that there will be an execution. It means the prisoners, some prisoners are going to be shot dead.
And one of them matches up with you?
Yes. So I have to come over and prepare myself to be to get the operation, kidney operation.
6 days later, according to the local newspaper, 45 prisoners were sentenced to death and executed on the same day, including one who apparently, even before he had been sentenced to death, was found to have the same blood and tissue type as Apple Yunuch.
So they were shot in the morning and the transplant was in the afternoon?
In the afternoon, yes.
Were there also other people who got transplants?
Yes, yes.
With kidneys from executed prisoners?
Yes.
In the course of our investigation, we also found that a big American corporation had played an important role here, the W.R. Grace Company, which through a joint business venture with the Chinese Army, equipped and helped to run a kidney dialysis center, where, in addition to routine dialysis, transplant patients are kept going while they await surgery upstairs.
W.R. Grace sold its kidney dialysis business last year, and a company spokesman denied that current management knew anything about the use of prisoners' kidneys for transplant. But a former top Grace executive, who regularly visited the hospital in China, told Primetime that he was well aware of what was going on there.
In our final meeting in New York with the Chinese doctor and his wife, who told us they were here on student visas and had connections back in China, we were assured the best medical care awaited us, and that the kidney we bought would come from a healthy prisoner who would be thoroughly tested before he was shot.
Regarding the prisoners' health, they're all given physical checkups and blood tests. They don't carry hepatitis or anything like that. all those carrying these diseases will be excluded. You see, there are so many criminals, they have a lot to choose from.
And then we gave the doctor what he had come for, $5,000 in cash, down payment for a healthy kidney from a prisoner in China. Federal law and the state laws of New York and Connecticut make it illegal to buy or sell any human organs.
Dr. Dye?
Hey. Yes?
Brian Ross from ABC News.
And when we entered the room with our camera showing, the doctor immediately denied knowing anything about prisoners or executions.
Aren't you here selling the organs of prisoners who have been executed in China?
No.
You're not?
No.
What do you think the $5,000 was
for? $5,000 introduced is a kind of service charge, right?
How many people have you introduced to China?
No.
How many?
No, I don't want to. I think it's my business. Yeah!
By some estimates, the kidney business has meant tens of millions of dollars to the Chinese military, which, even as the black market has expanded around the world, continues to deny any such business actually exists. In a letter to Primetime, the Chinese embassy in Washington suggested we stop production of our story, saying, quote, "The so-called sale of criminals' organs in China is a deliberate fabrication with ill intentions, and that in the rare instance when a prisoner's organ is used, the death row criminals voluntarily sign up."
Yeah, you're
Dr. Gutman says that makes a mockery of international principles adopted in the wake of Nazi medical experiments.
There's no such thing as, first of all, as consent when you're talking about incarcerated people. To say, well, we can produce a piece of paper that the prisoner has given consent before we kill him, is kind of a ludicrous thing.
No other country in the world is known to use the organs of prisoners except for China, which, based on our Primetime Live investigation, appears to have turned its chilling executions of thousands of people into a multi-million dollar black market of a kind the world has never seen.
You're listening to Media Monarchy on the Portland Radio Authority, praradio.com and mediamonarchy.blogspot.com. And you can send me an email at mediamonarchy@yahoo.com. Moving on through the news, it's been quite an interesting week for the Bush family after he got back from Asia and Vietnam. White House staffer beaten and robbed. This comes from the Hawaii Channel. The acting director of the White House Travel Office was robbed and beaten in Waikiki early on Tuesday morning outside of a nightclub, according to Honolulu police. He was knocked down, punched, kicked, his wallet and ID were stolen, Honolulu Police Department Captain Frank Fuji said. Greg Pitt's passport and international phone were also taken. Pitts left the bar alone. He walked through International Marketplace, where he was confronted by three men, beaten up and robbed, according to a source familiar with the case. His friends went looking for him and found him lying in a pool of blood. People familiar with Waikiki said muggings happen occasionally. Police said they have no evidence of an increase in violence against tourists. Pitts accompanied President George W. Bush on a brief visit to Hawaii. The stop came after an eight-day trip to Asia. While Bush stayed at Hickam Air Force Base, White House staff, crew from the airplane, and reporters stayed at Hilton Hawaiian Village in Waikiki. Paramedics treated Pitts and took him to Queens Medical Center. He did not return with the president to Washington. Now, another story comes right to the Hickam Air Force Base. Officers in President's motorcade involved in accidents, and this is coming from KPUA. Four Honolulu police officers were injured when they crashed their motorcycles while escorting President Bush's motorcade during his stop on Oahu. This morning, three were seen lying on the grass of the Hickam Air Force Base near their overturned motorcycles as the motorcade passed by, taking Bush to a breakfast with Hawaii troops. One solo bike officer hit a slippery spot near a curve in the road before crashing. Police say two other officers lost control of their bikes while trying to avoid the accident. One officer had internal bleeding and remained at the Queens Medical Center in critical condition. The two other officers were treated and released. Police did not release their names. In another incident, a fourth solo bike officer crashed and injured his wrist when attempting a U-turn on loose gravel last night. He was also treated and released. So there's a lot of interesting comparisons as I was looking at the anniversary of JFK's assassination, Secret Service stand down, and then there was Rex and Bush's motorcade and people being beaten up at nightclubs, and I believe also Jenna Bush's purse and cell phone were just stolen in Argentina a few days ago. Our next story on Media Monarchy, Selective Service, ready for a draft, and this is coming from CNN. Although Congress is unlikely to follow calls from a top Democrat to bring back the military draft, the United States does have a plan, if necessary, aimed at inducting millions of young men for service. The Selective Service System, an agency independent of the Defense Department, says it's ready to respond quickly to any crisis that would threaten to overwhelm the current all-volunteer military. We're the fire department, said spokesman Pat Schubach at the service headquarters in Arlington, Virginia. We're prepared to do the mission with whatever time period we're asked to do it in. Our current plan is 193 days, and that was based on manpower analysis. With an active list of more than 15 million names, Schubach said an estimated 93% of all men in the United States between 18 and 26 have registered for the Selective Service as required by law. Chris Baker of Decatur, Georgia, said he wouldn't support a draft under any circumstances. I don't believe it's right to send people who don't really want to go fight for the country, Baker said. I probably wouldn't go, but I know that I have to go to jail for that. That's probably what I would do, sit in jail. But 25-year-old Donnie Dearman of West Blockton, Alabama, said he would feel obligated to participate in a military draft. I'd have to do it. My dad did two tours of duty for Vietnam and for this country, Dearman said. I wouldn't want to leave my kids behind, but I wouldn't argue about it. While U.S. commanders insist sending more U.S. troops is not the answer in Iraq, they concede they really couldn't maintain a much bigger force than the 150,000 deployed there now because the U.S. military is just too small. Representative Charles Rangel of New York, the Democrat who will likely head the powerful House Ways and Means Committee in the next congressional session, said Sunday on CBS's Face the Nation he plans to propose a new military draft next year. Next year is coming up soon. Our next story on Media Monarchy, new Bond film highlights 9/11 insider trading, and this is coming from the fine folks at Infowars.com. In a 21st century update, the new James Bond movie Casino Royale directly references 9/11 and highlights the fact that massive manipulation of airline stocks prior to the attacks account for a leading motive behind the event. The movie, based on the original 1953 novel, has been updated with a terrorism plotline in which the bad guy, Le Chiffre, is a banker to the world's terrorists, and in order to stop him and bring down the terrorist network, Bond must beat Le Chiffre in a $150 million poker game at the Casino Royale. The movie contains a significant reference to 9/11 when M, the fictional head of MI6, tells Bond the following. When they analyzed the stock market after 9/11, the CIA discovered there had been massive shorting of airline stocks. When the stocks hit bottom on 9/12, somebody made a fortune. In the film, Bond prevents the same thing happening again with the Boeing stock by thwarting the bombing of an Airbus prototype plane at Miami Airport. With their prototype destroyed, the company would have been near bankruptcy. Instead, someone, we later discover it's Le Chiffre, loses over $100 million betting the wrong way as Bond foils the plot. As has been extensively reported over the past 5 years, multiple sources of criminal insider trading were discovered after 9/11, indicating that many different parties had prior knowledge of the attacks. The most significant instances of this, however, are ones obviously not revealed in the Bond film, are the CIA and FBI-linked cases that indicate the intelligence services at best had prior knowledge of the attacks and at worst were involved in their orchestration. The London Independent, among others, reported that the firm used to buy many of the put options, where a trader in effect bets on a share price fall, on United Airlines stock was headed until 1998 by Buzzy Krongard, at the time the executive director of the CIA. Until 1997, Mr. Krongard was chairman of Alex Brown Incorporated, America's oldest investment banking firm. Alex Brown was acquired by Bankers Trust, which in turn was bought by Deutsche Bank. His last post before resigning to take his senior role in the CIA was to head Bankers Trust, Alex Brown's private client business, dealing with the accounts and investments of wealthy customers around the world. Other publications reported similar stories concerning FBI personnel. On the other hand, it's quite surprising to see that such a reference to the shorting of airline stocks made it into the Bond movie, primarily because the 9/11 Commission spectacularly omitted it from their investigation into the attacks. One would think that any investigation would attempt to follow the money, as it were, to trace the funding of and profits made from the attack in an attempt to discover the perpetrators. Apparently not in this case. The commission also failed to look into the fact that the head of the Pakistani intelligence agency, General Mahmoud Ahmed, wired $100,000 to the lead hijacker, Mohammed Atta, in the days before 9/11. General Mahmoud Ahmed was having breakfast on the morning of 9/11 with Porter Goss, the head of the House Intelligence Committee and the next head of the CIA. Is the 9/11 reference a simple plot device in Casino Royale? Is it an attempt by the scriptwriters to further blow the whistle on the insider trading? Or is it an attempt to steam valve the information, to mix fiction with reality and thus confuse the two? In another item of interest to InfoWars reader, the film on general release now also features Bond being chipped with a tracking device in his forearm, which at one point saves his life. I'm sure it does. Now we're going to jump to something quite fantastic, also a film. This film's called Who Killed John O'Neill, and you can link to it off of MediaMonarchy.blogspot.com. This film was produced and directed by another Oregonian, a guy named Ty Rober. So let's listen to a good bit of Who Killed John O'Neill.
Who killed John O'Neill?
Who killed John O'Neill?
Who killed John O'Neill?
Anything but think. I know they did it. I want to prove it. I have to prove it.
What?
I have to prove it.
I don't know if I should.
I must.
I have to.
Should I? Council on Foreign Relations, Trilateral Commission, Bilderberg Group,
CIA,
Kissinger,
CIA, everybody.
Everybody.
A lot more people know about
it. Out the
puzzle. Why do they care?
Council on Foreign Relations has controlled the world for 50 years. You can go on their website and read about it.
Am I the only person who feels the need to know more?
I'm afraid this obsession
will be all
I'm
for
more
not,
afraid.
I am more afraid.
Don't become
of being like everyone else. I am more afraid
of being
at the 9/11. I was like everyone else.
Flag-waving patriot.
I thought Al-Qaeda did it, too. I thought we should bomb the Arabs straight back to the fucking Stone Age, just like everybody else.
Bomb them straight to hell.
Then I read about John O'Neill.
Maverick counterterrorism expert in the FBI. O'Neill tracked Osama bin Laden since 1995.
You know more about Osama than anyone in the world.
Tracked him past the embassy bombings in 98, Cole bombing in 2000. He knew more about Osama and Al-Qaeda than anyone in the world.
Isn't that interesting?
Then O'Neill, he got into some trouble. His investigations into terrorism were blocked from up on high.
Blocked by whom?
In the summer of 2001, he resigned as deputy director of the FBI. At the same time, he was publicly opposed to the anti-terrorism policies of President George W. Bush. On September 10th, 2001, he started his new job with a company called Kroll Associates, head of security at the World Trade Center. A day later, he was dead. A victim of the September 11th terrorist attack.
The World Trade Center.
Come on!
Come on!
The FBI's top counterterrorism expert, who after chasing bin Laden for 6 years, happened to take a job in the private sector. He was murdered in an internationally televised terrorist attack, blamed on his arch nemesis.
Killed by his arch nemesis. How ironic.
Coincidence? Fate?
Conspiracy.
Conspiracy. Why did O'Neill start working at the World Trade Center? Why were his investigations into Al-Qaeda stopped? Who arranged for him to get his new ill-fated job? I know the answers to these questions now. None of them have anything to do with Osama bin Laden. The more you look at the whole and not just the pieces,
you don't know anything.
The more you understand what really happened. John O'Neill is the key. Look into John O'Neill.
Robert Mueller.
John found out that Osama wanted the World Trade Center building up at 7. You want to know where that came from?
26.
John Miller.
It was
John
Federal Bunker Office.
Guess who?
Along with federal agent
John O'Neill.
Great friends.
Get up.
Jerome Howard.
Brian
Jerome.
Mike Howard.
William Bratt.
Jerome Howard.
Everybody have a guy who got John O'Neill his job at the World Trade Center.
You'll know everything.
Soviets their Vietnam War. It destroyed their economy and dispelled support of communism.
It was a smart thing to do, wasn't it?
Well, not without a price. See, during the war, the U.S., U.K., and Pakistan all supported groups of Arab fighters known as the Mujahideen. Two of the freedom fighters were Ramzi Youssef and Osama bin Laden. Books printed by the University of Nebraska and paid for by the U.S. Department of Education taught the Mujahideen radical theories of Islam and treated them to math problems and literature exercises riddled with allusions to guns, bombs, tanks, just overall general killing. You know, they trained them to be violent, and then they wonder why they become terrorists.
It would seem that creating a radical branch of Islam pales in comparison to ending the Cold War.
It would seem that way, yes. But after the Soviets withdrew, the Mujahideen were left without political support in a war-torn, impoverished, and socially unstable nation-state. So they started a second resistance movement, this time aimed toward the United States. And the primary group formed at this time, in the late 80s, was Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda was an intelligence operation from the start, straight up to now.
That's a very dangerous thing to say.
Even though it's true. See, from its inception, Al-Qaeda has been trained, funded, armed, and supported by the Pakistani Intelligence Agency, the ISI. The ISI, by its own disclosure, is an arm of the American CIA.
It's a very ominous association by what happened on 9/11.
It's not the first time it came back to bite us in the ass. Iran-Contra, the Sandinistas in Nicaragua. I mean, there are plenty of others that haven't been as widely reported as that one.
Iran-Contra is not a far cry from the CIA's involvement with Al-Qaeda.
Contra channeled money to states already considered terrorist nations like Iran, Iraq, Libya, Lebanon. And as the other half of the handshake, trillions of dollars in illegal narcotics have made their way into this country from the Middle East, the Far East, and Latin America. It shows a pattern of fraud and complicity by the U.S. government to promote instability abroad to further their domestic agenda. And it goes a long way to explain its governance of the ISI and Al-Qaeda.
It is frightening how tightly ISI and Al-Qaeda fit together, isn't it?
It's more frightening how often the major media typically ignore it.
The media seem too busy trying to scare us all into submission.
Yeah. By aiding the government and covering up the truth and thereby giving credence to the bogus official story.
Where is ISI in the official story?
The official story of 9/11 implicates a man named Omar Sheikh Saeed as the paymaster for lead hijacker Mohammed Atta, and a man named Khalid Sheikh Mohammed as the operational mastermind behind the attacks. Both men are well-known ISI agents.
How do I know the name Saeed?
Well, probably because he's one of the most infamous terrorists known to man. You may know him by another name, too, because he has about a half dozen aliases. But his big claim to fame is his conviction for the kidnapping and murder of Wall Street Journal reporter Daniel Pearl in February of 2002.
Daniel Pearl was killed by an ISI agent?
By the very man the government claims assisted in the 9/11 attacks. Pearl's on his way to meet Saeed when he disappeared. Saeed, using one of his aliases, knew that Pearl was investigating ISI ties to Al-Qaeda and 9/11.
I thought Pearl was killed because he was Jewish.
But it's far more likely he was killed by a high-ranking ISI agent to make sure he didn't print in a major U.S. newspaper ISI's connections to Al-Qaeda.
Because that, in turn, would implicate the CIA.
Well, think about it. If Al-Qaeda is funded by the ISI, and the ISI is funded by the CIA, 2 plus 2... Spore. What I am saying is, even though it's virtually impossible to believe the official story of 9/11, on the off chance it is true, the CIA, and therefore this government, is guilty of negligence for continuing to function as a liaison between Pakistan and Al-Qaeda.
So no matter what happened, if it was them, if it was us, if it was anybody, the CIA is guilty anyway? It sounds like you just want the CIA to be guilty.
He's on to us. He's CIA. Get off the phone. Okay, you are putting this whole thing in jeopardy. Okay, you were talking about open lines to someone you don't know, and you were telling him everything. Okay, so just put it in your head. Keep it in your head. Right up here. Just talk to me. Don't talk to him. Talk to me. Sound good?
What are you doing here?
What? I am here to keep you from making a huge mistake, okay? The post out of the world, you cannot trust anybody, especially no you and I know.
I understand.
Okay, good.
I understand now.
Hey, no. Okay, you understand. Let's go pack a bag. Get your stuff, and let's get out of here. We still get out of here if we do not.
No.
What?
I'm not going anywhere.
Okay. The CIA hit squads. Okay, CIA hit squads they're coming up the stairs. Oh, there are plenty of people. Whole heads, AK-47s and black vests, man. You know they're coming. Black helicopters on time. They're coming. Take us to an underground bunker somewhere and tie power batteries to our nuts. There is no one coming up here.
Oh, God.
Written and directed by Oregonian Ty Rober. That's the first 15 minutes of a film called Who Killed John O'Neill? And you can watch that by clicking on the link under the videos on MediaMonarchy.blogspot.com, or you can go to WKJO.com. In a story that dovetails nicely with the nexus of Kroll, Marshall McLennan, Silverstein, there's a company called the Blackstone Group, which in the news this last week from the International Herald Tribune, Blackstone acquiring firm in richest buyout. Blackstone Group, a private investment firm, has agreed to acquire Equity Office Properties Trust, the largest office building owner and manager in the United States, for about $36 billion. Also in the news from BBC, plan to create human-cow embryos. UK scientists have applied for permission to create embryos by fusing human DNA with cow eggs. And also, Mothers Against Drunk Driving wants alcohol sensors in cars. As a first step in trying to rein in DUI, Mothers Against Drunk Driving will campaign for the introduction of alcohol sensors in every car so as to detect the presence of alcohol in vehicles. Also, from the International Herald Tribune earlier this week, outsourcing hits a new class of workers, journalists. The long arm of offshoring reaches into the news industry. You're listening to Media Monarchy on the Portland Radio Authority, praradio.com, and mediamonarchy.blogspot.com. Next in the news, coming from the AP, Global Hawk to fly first mission over U.S. They've become a fixture in the skies over Iraq and Afghanistan, a new breed of unmanned aircraft operated with remote controls by pilots sitting in virtual cockpits many miles away. But the Air Force's Global Hawk has never flown a mission over the United States. That is set to change Monday when the first Global Hawk is scheduled to land at Beale Air Force Base in Northern California. This landmark flight has historic implications since it's the first time a Global Hawk has not only flown from Beale, but anywhere in the United States on an official Air Combat Command mission, base spokesman Captain Michael Andrews said in a statement. Beale-based pilots are flying the drones daily on combat missions in the Middle East, Andrews said. The planes are operated by four-person crews from virtual cockpits the size of shipping containers. The planes are designed to fly at high altitudes for 40-hour missions covering as much as 10,000 miles, mostly providing aerial surveillance. The aircraft, which can cost more than $80 million each, can reach an altitude of 65,000 feet and send back high-resolution imagery. The Hawks are among a growing fleet of unmanned aircraft that also includes the missile-carrying Predators and 5-pound Ravens that are small enough to be carried in soldiers' backpacks. Beale is to have 7 Global Hawks by 2009. It is currently the only U.S. base with the drones. Eventually, the Air Force's fleet will include 54 of the Global Hawks, but most will be based overseas. And then that leaves the rest of them for here. Our next story, U.S. won't standardize autopsies of 9/11 workers, and this is coming from the Washington Post. The federal government has abandoned an effort to create standard autopsy guidelines that could document a link between toxic air at Ground Zero and deaths of rescue workers, citing concerns that the data could be misinterpreted. The chief medical officer for the city fire department said one of the study's insurmountable barriers included the possibility that the information could be used in civil lawsuits by lawyers and others with an undeniable self-interest in the cause of death. The National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health, in a note posted Friday on its website, said the agency instead will pursue other avenues for documenting long-term health effects from exposure to air contaminants from the World Trade Center disaster. Outside medical experts who reviewed the original plan had raised several questions, the Institute said, including concerns that the draft document could be misinterpreted or misapplied, hindering rather than furthering progress in addressing WTC health concerns. The collapse of the Twin Towers sent thick plumes of concrete dust, fiberglass, asbestos, and lead into the air in lower Manhattan. The tainted air was taken in by thousands of workers at Ground Zero in the weeks after the terrorist attacks, which killed about 2,750 people in New York. Yesterday, meanwhile, 70 trucks began pouring the concrete base for the signature skyscraper at the New World Trade Center. The base will anchor the concrete core of the 776-foot Freedom Tower. Next month, the first steel beams for the towers are scheduled to rise. The work has continued despite calls from some family members of victims to halt construction. A search for human remains continues in the area after more than 200 bones were found recently in manholes on the site's western edge. John Cahill, chief of staff for Governor George Pataki, said that the city needs to be sensitive to victims' families, but that it's time to build this site. And those are all stories and things that spiderweb off of other stories and things that we've covered here in the previous week's own Media Monarchy, the toxic dust, and all the others. So that story is on MediaMonarchy.blogspot.com. It's got tons of links and documentation to all the dirt. Our next story, suing Rumsfeld, and this is coming from Raw Story. And it has an accompanying video clip that you can see on Media Monarchy. CNN interviews Cyrus Carr, an Iranian-American filmmaker who is suing ex-U.S. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld for wrongful imprisonment and the violation of his constitutional rights. In Iraq, to film a historical documentary, Carr was charged with being a terrorist and placed in the notorious prison at Abu Ghraib. He was held for 55 days, most of them in solitary confinement. After 49 days, he was finally given a hearing and eventually freed. Rumsfeld has filed motions to have the suit dismissed. A hearing in January will determine if Carr's lawsuit can go forward. And now we're going to listen to the accompanying clip from CNN, by way of YouTube, by way of MediaMonarchy.blogspot.com.
This is CNN, the most trusted name in news. Now back to the CNN newsroom.
He went to a war zone to make a movie, but he became the key player in a real-life prison drama. Now, this filmmaker is suing Donald Rumsfeld. CNN's Randy Kaye explains.
Cyrus Carr is an Iranian-American who went to Iraq last year to film a historical documentary. It had nothing to do with the war. But just days after arriving, his trip took a stunning turn. Carr landed at the notorious Abu Ghraib prison where, he says, U.S. troops called him the American terrorist.
I could hear him in what must have been their standard mantra, which was, "You effing terrorists, you're here to kill Americans, you effing terrorists."
So how did this Los Angeles filmmaker who's lived in the U.S. since kindergarten, this Navy veteran, end up a suspected terrorist? Carr says his taxi, driven by an Iraqi, was stopped at a checkpoint. The car's trunk was searched, and Carr, his cameraman, and the driver were arrested for plotting to build roadside bombs.
They found 36 washing machine timers.
Did you know those were in there?
No.
Did you know what they were being used for?
No.
Washing machine timers are widely used by insurgents to trigger IEDs on roadsides. In time, Carr says his taxi driver would admit the timers were his. But when Carr was handed over to U.S. forces, he says his hands and feet were bound and he was left to bake for hours in a cage in 120-degree heat. He remembers a hood over his head nearly suffocated him.
Did you think you were going to die there at that point?
I remember I kept telling myself, stay awake. You won't die today. Stay awake.
Carr says he showed U.S. troops his passport and his veteran's card, but they still took him to Abu Ghraib. After Abu Ghraib, Carr says he was thrown into solitary confinement for 2 months at the same prison as Saddam Hussein. If Carr's story is true, why would the U.S. treat one of its own citizens this way?
Saddam Hussein received more due process than Cyrus Carr did.
The ACLU's Mark Rosenbaum represents Carr in a lawsuit against Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld and other high-ranking military officials. They say Rumsfeld's replacement will also be added to the suit. The lawsuit claims the U.S. government deprived Cyrus Carr of his constitutional rights and violated the Geneva Convention.
But holding people incommunicado in the hellholes of places like Abu Ghraib, that's not acceptable. And that's Constitution 101.
A spokesman for coalition forces says Carr was treated fairly and humanely, consistent with the standards set by the Geneva Convention. But Rosenbaum says Carr passed a lie detector test. And after all, the taxi driver did admit the washing machine timers were his. Still, he says, Carr was refused a lawyer.
While Cyrus Carr was being interrogated in Iraq, he had no idea he was also being investigated back here at home. In a midnight raid, FBI agents turned his Los Angeles apartment upside down. They confiscated two computers, credit card statements, phone records, and airline tickets. None of it provided any evidence to warrant keeping him in Iraq.
Also, Carr says he was held for 55 days, 53 in solitary confinement. In fact, 49 days passed before he even had a hearing. Why did it take so long to free an innocent American?
Does a lawsuit like this, though, really have any legs? I mean, you think about suing Don Rumsfeld, General Casey. You really think you're going to get somewhere?
The government's saying that what they did was perfectly lawful. And so I think this lawsuit is the only chance that citizens like Cyrus have in restoring what the basic principles are.
Secretary Rumsfeld and the other defendants have filed motions to dismiss the case. The Department of Justice argues the length of the plaintiff's detention was well in keeping with the exigencies of ongoing hostilities in Iraq and the needs to ascertain fully and accurately his true status. It adds, once the tribunal assessed the plaintiff's case, military personnel took only 6 days to review the decision and make arrangements to release the plaintiff. A hearing to determine if Carr's lawsuit will go forward is set for January.
At some point while you were there, did you say to yourself, maybe I shouldn't have come to Iraq in the height of war to shoot this documentary about some Persian leader that's been gone 2,500 years?
You know, I think a lot of people might find me crazy for this, but no, I never regretted my decision.
Cyrus Carr's documentary would have been about a great Persian conqueror, a ruler considered by many to be the father of human rights. The irony was not lost on Cyrus Carr. Randy Kaye, CNN, Los Angeles.
You're listening to Media Monarchy on the Portland Radio Authority, praradio.com and mediamonarchy.blogspot.com. Our next bit of news is coming from the Associated Press. Indonesians protest ahead of Bush visit. Warmly greeted by leaders in Vietnam, President Bush drew a different reaction Sunday at his upcoming stop in Indonesia, where thousands angrily protested America's policy in the Middle East and wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. The White House said it was confident about security precautions for Bush's visit Monday, despite police warnings of an increased threat of attack by Al-Qaeda-linked groups. The president was to spend just 6 hours in Indonesia, most of it at Bogor Palace, a presidential retreat outside the capital of Jakarta and far from the scenes of protest, where Bush was denounced as a war criminal and terrorist. While Indonesian president is a close ally of the U.S. in the war on terror, Bush is highly unpopular in Indonesia, the world's most populous Muslim nation. It was Bush's first appearance on the world stage since his Republican Party lost control of Congress and was rebuked for the unpopular war in Iraq. And from that, we jump to the forthcoming unpopular war on Iran. CIA analysis finds no Iranian nuke drive, and this is coming from the Agence France-Presse. AFP, a classified draft CIA assessment has found no firm evidence of a secret drive by Iran to develop nuclear weapons, as alleged by the White House, a top U.S. investigative reporter has said. Seymour Hersh, writing in an article for the November 27th issue of the magazine The New Yorker, released in advance, reported on whether the administration of Republican President George W. Bush was more or less inclined to attack Iran after Democrats won control of Congress last week. A month before the November 7th legislative elections, Hersh wrote, Vice President Dick Cheney attended a national security discussion that touched on the impact of Democratic victory in both chambers on Iran policy. If the Democrats won on November 7th, the Vice President said that victory would not stop the administration from pursuing a military option with Iran, Hirsch wrote, citing a source familiar with the discussion. Cheney said the White House would circumvent any legislative restrictions and thus stop Congress from getting in its way, he said. The Democratic victory unleashed a surge of calls for the Bush administration to begin direct talks with Iran. But the administration's planning of a military option was made far more complicated in recent months by a highly classified draft assessment by the CIA, challenging the White House's assumptions about how close Iran might be to building a nuclear bomb. The CIA found no conclusive evidence as yet of a secret Iranian nuclear weapons program running parallel to civilian operations that Iran has declared to the International Atomic Energy Agency. A current senior intelligence officer confirmed the existence of the CIA analysis and said the White House had been hostile to it. Cheney and his aides had discounted the assessment. "They're not looking for a smoking gun," the official was quoted as saying, referring to specific intelligence about Iranian nuclear planning. "They're looking for the degree of comfort level they think they need to accomplish the mission." The United States and other major powers believe Iran's uranium enrichment program is ultimately aimed at producing fissile material for nuclear weapons. Iran insists it will use the enriched uranium only to fuel nuclear power stations, something it is permitted to do as a signatory of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. The major powers have been debating a draft UN resolution drawn up by Britain, France, and Germany that would impose limited sanctions on Iran's nuclear and ballistic missile sectors for Tehran's failure to comply with an earlier UN resolution on halting enrichment. On Wednesday, Israel's outgoing U.S. Ambassador Danny Ayalon said in an interview that Bush would not hesitate to use force against Iran to halt its nuclear program if other options failed. U.S. President George W. Bush will not hesitate to use force against Iran in order to halt its nuclear program, Ayalon told Mariv Daily. Israel, widely considered the Middle East's sole, if undeclared, nuclear power, views Iran as its arch foe, pointing to repeated calls by President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad to wipe the Jewish state off the map. And you can click to all kinds of links in that story, including the full statements from Ahmadinejad that take out of context his statement that he wants to wipe the Jewish state off the map. In other news, Kissinger says an Iraq military win is impossible. And the Washington Post reports that military victory is no longer possible in Iraq, former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger said in a television interview broadcast Sunday. Kissinger presented a bleak vision of Iraq, saying the U.S. government must enter into dialogue with Iraq's regional neighbors, including Iran, if progress is to be made in the region. "If you mean by military victory an Iraqi government that can be established and whose writ runs across the whole country, that gets the civil war under control and sectarian violence under control in a time period that the political processes of the democracies will support, I don't believe that is possible." In related news, Tony Blair admits Iraq is a disaster. Coming from the Daily Mail, Tony Blair admitted that British intervention in Iraq has been a disaster last night, sending shockwaves through Westminster. In his frankest admission about the war to date, Mr. Blair admitted that Western forces have been powerless to stop the descent into violence. The Prime Minister stopped short of accepting blame for plunging Iraq to the brink of civil war, blaming instead the insurgent uprising that has killed 125 British troops. But his admission in an interview with the Arab news channel Al Jazeera will be seen in this historic climb down for Mr. Blair, who has always fought to put a positive gloss on often disastrous events. And that interview is with Sir David Frost. Coming from military.com and other sources, Pentagon announces U.S. troop deployments to Iraq. The Pentagon announced Friday, that's last Friday, that 57,000 U.S. troops, including five combat brigades, have been told to deploy to Iraq early next year, a move that will maintain current force levels there. Defense Secretary Ronald Rumsfeld signed the deployment orders for about 20,000 soldiers from active Army brigades based in North Carolina, Georgia, Washington, Kansas, and Italy. Another 10,000 reserves and 27,000 active duty troops are scheduled to go to Iraq in smaller units. The announcement comes as some Democrats, who are poised to take control of the House and Senate, continue to press for substantial reduction of U.S. troops in Iraq and a timetable for that drawdown. You're listening to Media Monarchy on the Portland Radio Authority, praradio.com, and mediamonarchy.blogspot.com.
This is a call out to all the youth in the ghettos, suburbs, villages, townships. To all the kids who download this song for free, by any means. To all the kids sort of loop but high on dreams. All the kids watching TV like yo, I wish it was me. But all the kids pressing rewind and let's get free. I hear you. To all the people within the sound of my voice.
Closing out this fourth episode of Media Monarchy on the Portland Radio Authority, praradio.com and mediamonarchy.blogspot.com. I thank you for listening, and as always, for all these things that you hear on the show, you can go to mediamonarchy.blogspot.com and hit all the links and all the documentation and all the videos and all the audio clips. So in review, we went over everything from the C-SPAN 3 broadcast this weekend on 9/11 and the American Empire, American Intellectuals Speak Out, China and their ever-growing, ever-widening organ harvesting. We listened to a bit of Who Killed John O'Neill, and you can go to WKJO.com and watch that entire feature-length film made by Oregonian Ty Rober. And I thank you. And I hope that you'll join me next week and every week at 10 a.m. Pacific Time on the Portland Radio Authority for Media Monarchy. If you like the show, tell somebody about it. If you like the blog, send the link around, mediamonarchy.blogspot.com. You can hit me up on email, mediamonarchy@yahoo.com. And I will be back next Friday at 10 a.m. with all the news that's fit to suppress. My name's James. This has been Media Monarchy. Thanks for listening. Take care.
Made no difference. The thought police would get him just the same.